UK Wine Show, show number 288. Professor Rainer Jong from Geisenheim on oxidation and PET bottles. Guten Tag and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and in the wine show this week we're talking with Professor Rainer Jong from Geisenheim. We're going to be talking to him about oxidation and the new PET or plastic bottles that have been coming onto the market in the last wee while. In the spotlight, we're going to be looking at our poll question. What type of sparkling wines will you be mostly drinking to celebrate Christmas? Or sparkling wines had you drunk over Christmas? This week, I've tried a few sparkling wines. Some sparkling Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand, which were pretty good. I've been to the New Zealand trade tasting, and I've also been to one of my suppliers, Bibendum's trade tasting. And I did try some nice sparkling Sauvignon Blancs. You may recall a couple of years ago I tried them and panned them a bit, actually. I wasn't too impressed. I tried three different sparkling Sauvies from New Zealand this week, and they were all pretty drinkable. You may remember last week I requested if anybody had heard of a Parisian wine shop from the 1930s. Hadn't heard anybody about that, and tweeted it as well, so I haven't heard back from anybody. If you've got any ideas about that Parisian wine shop from the 1930s, it'd be good to hear from you. You can email me at chris.scott@3050.co.uk. Or you can tweet me at Winescriber. If you recall, there's a person writing a book that needs a Parisian wine shop for part of their settings. So if you've got any ideas, do give us a call. But without further ado, let's crack on to this week's mystery wine region. And as usual, you've got to try and work out what the mystery wine region is. I'm going to give you a clue now, clue before the interview, and then the answer at the end of the show. So, our mystery wine region is an 18,000 square mile valley. And it's known as an AVA, or American Viticultural Area, and it's a premium wine-producing region that encompasses virtually all vineyards in eastern Washington. That's Washington State, not Washington, the capital city, in the northwest corner of the United States. Since more than 99% of the state's total comes from the eastern part, this American Viticultural Area basically accounts for most of Washington State's wines. It's separated from Seattle's rainy climate by the Cascade Mountains, so annual rainfall is about a mere 6 to 8 inches, though there is a ready supply of water for irrigation by the nearby rivers, and the area is very hot, dry summers, and cold to freezing winters. Cool nights here help to keep the fresh acidity in the grapes despite the heat of the days. The advantage of the low rainfall is that things like mold and mildews aren't as much of a hazard, nor a pest such as sharpshooters, which can affect California quite badly. And that's because the colder winters keep them at bay. Have we think about the Washington State AVA, or the main AVA in Washington State? And I'll give you the answer after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Buying a bad bottle of Chardonnay may soon be a thing of the past if Henny Van Vuren has his way. Together with the Wine Research Centre at the University of British Columbia, the genes of 15 known clones of the Chardonnay grapevine will be mapped over 2 years, in an effort to identify which ones are best for planting. The project should help growers around the world pick the right clone for their individual geography, and that should mean better production and more consistent results. There are so many varietals of the Chardonnay clone, each with its own distinct properties, such as early or late ripening, loose or small bunches, seedless or large berries, and each of these properties might be important for certain areas. And that's no small matter in British Columbia, where the Chardonnay grape is the second most planted white varietal behind Pinot Gris, and of course it's the most popular white wine in the world.
I'm not sure how DNA mapping will provide better insights into where the grapes are grown. I can see how looking at a gene differences and seeing how they map different characteristics can give an insight into what genes control what behaviours, such as looser clusters or bigger berries, but I fail to see how looking at the genome will give insights that can't already be seen by looking at the fruit and the vine. Oh well, that's why scientists get paid the big bucks, I suppose. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, a Chinese man has been given a life sentence for illegally importing millions of dollars of fine wine into China from France, Britain and Hong Kong. Sun Zitai was convicted of forging invoices and import contracts to evade import duties on 70,000 bottles worth $7.1 million US dollars. between January 2004 and December 2009. The Beijing Times reported that he changed the name and price of high-end wines and claimed they were cheap wines to avoid the tax rate of up to 50% on wine, and said the punitive rate left him no choice but to smuggle the goods. The 60-year-old has already served a prison sentence for another offence in 2002 and imports other luxury goods such as Nike trainers and Oakley sunglasses.
I guess crime doesn't pay. Just watch out all those dodgy smugglers who go through Calais. You may only get a loss of a van and a slap on the wrist now, but I doubt if the UK would have such a problem with tax evaders if the penalties were this severe. What's the last story, Jane?
Finally, some good news. English wine growers are on a roll, with the number of hectares of vineyards planted in 2006 rising from 923 hectares to 1,500 hectares today. The boom has been aided by climate change, wealthy investors and a patriotic domestic market. But is the bubble about to burst? Well, many growers will be anxiously scrutinising their vines for signs of phylloxera. But there is a more serious potential problem for the UK, which is trunk disease. Also known as dead arm, black measles and black goo, it's caused by a fungus which can impair vine performance and eventually kill vines. And it's particularly prevalent in the UK on young and recently planted vines. Chris Foss of Plumpton College maintains the industry underestimates the seriousness of trunk disease, and a researcher said lots of producers are in denial, especially those whose vineyards have had disease for many years and haven't seen it. Out of 35 vineyards that Foss visited, all but one had the disease. Trunk diseases are as graphic as the results. The two most threatening diseases at this stage look to be Botrys ferrea, sometimes called bot canker, and Cylindrocarpon, sometimes called black foot disease. The former is easily transferred via pruning wounds. Worryingly, though, both diseases may already be present in recently planted nursery stocks. Unfortunately, there's no cure because it's hard to detect until the vine is pretty sick. However, it can be stopped from spreading by removing the infected plants, treating pruning wounds and replanting. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out these stories at 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. This is a bit of a worry, isn't it? Particularly if you've got a bit of bot canker. I tell you what, that sounds like something I don't want to get. But at least it's a simple job of removing the dead wood and then replanting. A bigger worry is that the nurseries in Europe have been supplying diseased material. This may not be a problem in drier parts of Europe, but in old Blighty, where the weather is not quite so forgiving, it's a real problem. Yes, from fungal diseases in the UK vineyards to this week's poll, we asked what sort of wines or sparkling wines that people will be celebrating Christmas with. Now, we ran this poll over December and January. We wanted to get a lot of results. We had 179 responses. And the answers were 49% of people champagne, 10% cava, 16% prosecco, other sparkling wine is 5%, and 20% of people won't be drinking fizz at all. Now, we asked this question two other times, in 2009 and 2008, and perhaps the biggest change has been the steady reduction of those drinking champagne. Down originally from 62% in 2008 and then 57% in 2009, the 49% this year is probably one of the lowest, and it may be a factor that people are spending less on wines. While the cheaper Prosecco has grown from 7% in 2008, 11% in 2009, and now stands at quite a healthy 16%. Perhaps the biggest winner, or should I say loser, is those not drinking sparkling wines at all. 6% in 2008, 13% in 2009, and now a massive 20% in 2011. Maybe it's because a few people don't feel like celebrating at the moment, but those who do drink cava, they've been pretty steady at 10%. It's ranged from 11% 08 and 9% in 2009 and 10% this year. The last big change has been other sparkling wines, down from 14% in 2008, and now only 5%. This bodes badly for those trying to break into the sparkling wine side of the business. There are some truly great champagne-like sparkling wines out there. The problem is that there's a lack of a brand to hang their hat on. Many producers make sparkling wines without a region being focused on making sparkling wines, and it's hard for them to generate noise and awareness for that. Prosecco has led the way, carving out a niche of being focused at producing good quality fizz. The UK and perhaps Tasmania are two that could do it, but these are still early days. New Zealand makes some fantastic traditional method sparkling wines at very good prices as well, But the new sparkling Sauvignon Blancs that we're starting to see a bit more of are also pretty good too. The problem is, they taste very different. But it's getting hard for people looking at the label to work out which one's different. And with the whole plethora of sparkling wines and Pinot Noir, etc. from New Zealand, I don't believe that there's a region that can really hang its hat on and say, we make sparkling wines, for people to get confident in. And I think with sparkling wine purchases, there's a lot of confidence that you need to have. That's possibly why Cava and Prosecco are doing so well. One wine region that doesn't make any sparkling wines, or hardly any sparkling wines, is our mystery wine region. And I'm going to give you the second clue in our mystery wine region. As I said, it is a valley, and it's 185 miles wide and 200 miles long. So it's a pretty big valley with 4.5 million hectares in it. Its geography is defined by the mountain ranges that border it to the west and north, and generally by the Columbia River to the south. Although the AVA continues east to include the southern part of the Walla Walla Valley AVA. Riesling, Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot and Syrah are popular in this region, though other varieties are planted too. Primarily on their own rootstocks thanks to the sandy soil which stops phylloxera pest. The valley has a collection of distinct growing regions, all classified as AVAs. These include the Yakima Valley appellation, which has about 40% of the state's vineyards, the Walla Walla Valley, Red Mountain, which is neither red nor a mountain, the Columbia Gorge, Rattlesnake Hills, Horseheaven Hills, Snipes Mountain, and Lake Chelan. That's your last clue in the mystery wine region. I'm going to give you the answer to the clue after the interview, which is coming up next with Professor Rainer Jung. Let's have a listen to what he has to say about oxidation and PET bottles.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Professor Rainer Jung. How are you, Professor?
Thank you. I'm fine.
Excellent. You're the Professor of Enology, or winemaking, as I like to call it, at Geisenheim, so quite quite an illustrious body. So are you a winemaker by profession?
Yes, I'm also a winemaker by profession, yes. I'm even coming from a wine-producing family, so I was growing up with winemaking.
How come you landed up here and doing academia as opposed to sort of producing Rieslings and all that sort of stuff in Germany?
I just studied here, and then I found some interesting research projects, and then I stayed here.
Okay, so fair enough. It's a nice place here in Geisenheim.
Yes, it is.
Excellent. So have you been here the whole time since degree?
Yes, I have been sometimes abroad. I've worked some time in California, but then I came back here. Yeah.
What we're going to talk about today is a wee bit about oxygen ingress and some of the different packagings. You've done some research into these sort of effects. We might even talk a wee bit about plastic corks, but oxygen ingress, broadly, that's oxygen getting into wine, isn't it? What can oxygen do to a wine?
It depends on what phase of the wine production oxygen comes into the wine. So, for example, as for the time before fermentation, a lot of research has been done, and it showed that it has not the biggest influence for the most varieties if you have an oxygen contact or not in this phase. Oxygen can improve the development of yeasts before.
Yeast needs a bit of oxygen, yes, doesn't it?
Before fermentation. But the problematic situation starts after fermentation. If there's no protection of the wine, if the barrel is not full, then oxygen can, do different things, can change aroma components of the wine, can change the phenolic situation in the wine. So after fermentation, it really gets interesting.
Sometimes a bit of oxygen before fermentation can be a good thing because it burn off some of the lighter aromas. And I understand, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but it can result in wines being a bit more stable for longer-term aging.
In general, it is more that the growing of the yeasts are going faster, and there's a bigger population, and then certainly you are changing the situation of fermentation, and certainly then you are changing also the situation of the aroma composition.
Oh, okay.
So I think this is an effect.
Is that more if you're doing wild fermentations, though, because you get a, as opposed to inoculated yeast?
No, it is also for fermentation without wild yeast.
How does the flavor change?
Yes, because you have a different quantity of yeast, and if you have a different quantity of yeast, the process of fermentation is going faster or slower or Yes. Mm-hmm. And then if you have a very fast fermentation, and if you don't cool the fermentation, you are losing a lot of aroma because you have a lot of CO2 in a short time. And if it goes slower, it's different.
Okay, so the wine's got some oxygen before fermentation. Fermentation is reductive, i.e. it absorbs oxygen, removes oxygen from the wine. Mm-hmm. So after fermentation, I imagine most wines have pretty low levels of oxygen. Mm-hmm. People talk about micro-oxidation.
For red wine, yes.
Yeah, just to soften tannins mm-hmm. and things like that. But a lot of work these days in oxidation is all about after bottling or at bottling time, mm-hmm. Particularly with screw caps, where if you don't have a wee bit of if you remove too much oxygen with a screw cap and hardly any oxygen gets in through the screw cap, you can sometimes land up with reductive flavors. But once the wine is ready for bottling or packaging, what are the key issues associated with oxidation at that point?
Yes, when the wine is ready for bottling, and then everybody is looking for SO2 content of the wine because he wants to bottle a stable wine. Mm-hmm. And then you store it in a tank. Mm-hmm. It starts already with that tank. If that tank is full or not, or if you have CO2 or nitrogen atmosphere over the wine or not, before bottling, and then you transport the wine into the filling machine. Yep. You can do that by pumping. You can do it with the inert gas, which would be the best way for protection against oxygen. And then you have different types of filling machines. You have long pipes, short pipes. You have evacuation of bottles or not.
Do those pipes not normally get flushed out with carbon dioxide first?
Not in any case.
No.
Okay. And then you can have an empty bottle which is full of carbon dioxide, or it can be full of oxygen mm-hmm. when you bottle it. And then you can fill it from the top with a short pipe, which goes a little bit faster if you want to have a fast running machine, or you can do it with a long pipe, which goes a little bit slower, but then you have this lower quantity of oxygen. Yeah.
Okay. So there's quite a few options there, even in bottling.
Yes.
Okay. And do winemakers typically look at the oxygen in the wine after bottling as well as before? Because they do their adjustment before bottling. So do you think they actually look at it afterwards just to see how these changes?
You know, I don't know if all winemakers are looking for the oxygen content before bottling. Very often they are looking for, with the indirect measurement, for the SO2 content.
Yeah.
They are taking care about that. But nowadays it is really correct to look for the oxygen in the wine before bottling. And in the wine after bottling.
How do you measure that?
There are very new systems to measure it, non-destructive methods, optochemical methods. You install in the bottle, you can install oxygen-sensitive spots in the headspace, uh-huh. but also in the wine. And then you can measure from outside. You illuminate that spot.
Yep.
With a light, and then you get a signal back. That light changes depending on the oxygen load of that spot, and then you know how many oxygen you have in the liquid or in the headspace.
Okay.
So you know how many oxygen you brought in with your process during bottling, and then you can change the process if you need to do that.
Let's look at the packaging now. I'm particularly interested in some of the plastic bottles because plastic bottles you're starting to see a bigger increase in plastic bottles in the UK,
mm-hmm.
Partly to do with the fact that you can't take glass into some concerts and things like that.
Yes, sure,
So they're quite good from that point of view. Some people like them from an environmental point of view. The first PET bottles polyethylene?
Terephthalate.
PET bottles.
Okay. Okay.
The first wave of PET bottles I saw were just single PET, single shell. And my understanding was PET isn't really a particularly good barrier to oxygen. Even my dad used to work for a bottling company for fizzy drinks. And when PET bottles first came out, the carbon dioxide used to go out through the bottles as well a wee bit. So how good is just a straight PET bottle in terms of keeping oxygen in and out?
It cannot be used for wine. It is just the oxygen just passes through it, and you cannot store a bottle of wine for a longer time with a normal PET.
How long would it normally be, do you think?
With a normal bottle, yeah. We never used that because you really have to do something against oxygen protection. Everybody told us before we started our experiments with PET bottles that it doesn't make sense to use a bottle without any protection. But I would say maybe 3 or 6 months, depending on the storage conditions, temperature especially. And in some cases, wines are stored at very high temperatures, and then you have acceleration of the chemical processes, and then also oxidation goes faster.
So you end up putting more sulfur dioxide or sulfides in the wines just to mop it up. Loading it up with sulfur. Mm. Okay. And some of the newer bottles I've heard about are multi-layer. So you get a PET, an oxygen scavenging layer, and then another PET bottle. So the oxygen passes through, but it doesn't actually make it to the wine because it gets sort of mopped up on the way through. No one will tell me what the scavenging layer is. Mm. Do you know what it is?
Yes. So there are it's two possibilities. You can use a scavenger, or you can have a multi-layer bottle, or you have both together.
A multi-layer, they use aluminium on the bag and box.
In this case, it would be aluminium, but there are also other materials. For example, even glass can be used. They bring in a very thin glass sealing inside of the bottle in one system, but they're using different materials to protect the oxygen going through. Using a scavenger as an easy scavenger is, for example, ascorbic acid.
In between the two slabs.
Which we could use, yes.
That's ascorbic acid, that's just vitamin C, isn't it?
Yes, it's vitamin C. It's just so it's very simple. But the problem of a scavenger is that after some time, the scavenger is gone because oxidation is going on and scavenger material is away. So after that time, you have the normal
degradation.
Yes.
Okay. And how long do this? Obviously, it depends on how much scavenger material and sulfur dioxide and all that sort of stuff. But if a non-protected bottle is 3 to 6 months, what would a multi-layer with a scavenging material be?
Again, depending on the storage conditions, I would say 12 months is no problem at all, but we also have bottles which are stored already for 24 months and they're still okay compared to glass.
Roseworthy do a lot of trials and they use Semillon a lot because they seem to think that Semillon is quite sensitive to oxidation and it's a good indicator. And are there other wines that are more stable or less stable? And what do you need to be more stable? I've heard that red wine is better in a PET bottle than a white wine, for example.
Yes, is that true? This is certainly correct because for red wine, a higher consumption of oxygen is possible. It changes the character too, but it will not change the character into oxidized situation like we have it in the white wine. This is depending on the phenolic constitution of those wines, which are absolutely different comparing a red wine to a white wine.
Yeah, you got a lot more stuff in there to mop it up, tannins and colors and all that sort of thing. Okay, so that's PET bottles. Mm-hmm. Do you think, like we've got a PET bottle here in front of us, 2007 Shiraz. Why do people want PET bottles if they've got short shelf lives? What is the advantage?
I think it is not interesting for people who want to store wine for a longer time. So, you know, they want to know how long could we store a wine in that bottle. But nobody would maybe store a PET bottle for 12 or 24 months. The reason to use it is that it's very light. So if you need to transport wine over a longer distance or, for example, in airlines, it is interesting for them.
But people you shouldn't really be transporting wines in planes.
No, for the companies, the air...
Oh, to drink the wine. Oh, yes, no, that's fine. I like to do
that. Yes.
Nothing wrong with drinking wine on a plane.
And for reasons like this or for going into parties, to concerts or things like that, it is interesting material. Transporting wine in ships or lorries from the bottler to the supermarket, yes, you're saving saving a lot of weight, and then you're saving a lot of energy to transport the material. That is the interesting aspect, I think.
Okay, well, that's PET bottles. I think we'll wrap it up there, and I think next week we'll have we chat about plastic stoppers.
Okay.
Excellent. Thanks very much.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Professor Reiner. Quite interesting about what he's saying. I'm particularly interested about the length of the PET bottles. 2 years is a fair old length of time, and I think that's quite good because it allows people to buy wine and they've got some flexibility, particularly if you consider that the wines are probably being brought in bulk from Australia or Chile or wherever the wine's being purchased, brought in bulk, bottled in the UK, and then sold through. So they might be in the supply chain for, say, 2-3 months before they're finally ready for sale, purchased, another couple of months. And if the wine lasts 2 years, you've got a good length of time. So as summer approaches and you're going to see Tesco's and Sainsbury's selling some of their wines in PET bottles, don't be afraid to try it. Remember, it's not the packaging, it's the quality of the wine they put into the packaging that's important. And to finish up is our answer to our mystery wine region, and it was Columbia Valley AVA. I thought the reference to the Columbia River was a pretty good big clue. I know it's a bit of a hard one, but the 18,000 square mile Columbia AVA is a premium wine producing region that encompasses virtually all the vineyards of eastern Washington in the northwest corner of the United States. Since more than 99% of the state's total comes from the eastern part, this American viticultural area basically accounts for the Washington state's wines. It's separated from Seattle's rainy maritime climate by the Cascade Mountains. And I must admit, Seattle has a reputation for being wet, and it is wet. I was in Seattle for about 4 or 5 months, 10-15 years ago, and it just drizzled the whole time. Didn't really rain, just misty drizzly the whole time. But if you pop over Cascade Mountains, that weather doesn't make it. So the annual rainfall here is only a mere 6 to 8 inches. Although it does have plenty of water from nearby rivers. And the area is hot, dry in summers, and cool to freezing in winters. Cool nights help to keep the fresh acidity in the grapes despite the heat of the days. And the advantage of the low rainfall is that, like most things, mold and mildew are kept at bay, as well as other pests such as the sharpshooters because the cold winters kill them off. Riesling, Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Syrah are popular in the region, though other varieties are planted too, primarily on their own rootstock thanks to a sandy soil that prevents the phylloxera pest. And to finish up with this week is our quote. And since we were looking at sparkling wines, this quote is about champagne. It's anonymous, but here is the quote. Here is to champagne, the drink divine that makes us forget all our troubles. It's made of $1 worth of wine and $3 worth of bubbles. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.